Welcome back to episode number 45 of the Avery Adventures podcast. Today on the show, we have Brad Brooks from Argali. Brad was nice enough to record his seminar down at the BHA, a rendezvous in Boise. The seminar kind of covers lightweight backpacking and techniques and tactics for hunting mule deer and a little bit about elk. As always, we are brought to you by MountainOps.com. Two of my favorite products from MountainOps are Phoenix for recovery. If you're a fat kid like me and you get after it, you get a little sore, you need a little Phoenix to help you recover a little faster. And Ignite, my favorite flavor of Ignite is Pina Colada. So go check them out at MountainOps.com. And here's Brad.
I'm going to try not to use him. Can you guys hear me in the back if I don't use a mic?
What?
Okay. I don't like to use mics and I walk around a lot. Well, thank you all for coming here today. I assume you're all not expecting Ryan Callahan to be here to talk about how to cut up an animal, but if you are, he's down the hall. So I'm going to talk to you about, we're going to talk a little bit about mule deer hunting and backcountry hunting, but before we do that, I want to tell you guys a story. And this is a story that I've never told publicly. This is actually a story that after I tell the story, you're probably going to understand why most of my friends don't know this story, okay? And you gotta like hang with me for a second as I tell this story because it'll tie into what I'm going to talk about today. So if you know anything about, so my name is Brad Brooks, and there are three Brooks brothers in my family, and there's actually we're all here today, so you can see all three of us trolling around here. And my older brother Curtis is a year and a half older than me, and my younger brother Brian is 4.5 years younger than me. And when so Curtis and I, we were growing up, we were a pack, we were a team. And we were some, we did a lot of, to put it lightly, a lot of dumb shit together as kids. And we got into a lot of trouble. And to give you an example, I was told that we were known as kind of being some aggressive kids. And to give you an example of the kind of kids we were, one time my brother and I were having a conversation in the kitchen. This is like, we were probably like 6 years old. I was six, he was probably seven at the time. And he was at one end of the kitchen. I was at the other, and he was drinking water out of a glass, made of glass, and he didn't like what I was saying to him. And we played baseball on the same baseball team, and he was a pitcher. And he threw the glass at my face, and it connected with me in my eye and exploded. And that was just like, that was a very normal situation in our household, okay? Another time, my brother and I were wrestling. We had, you know, we had bunk beds, so he slept on the top bunk, I was on the bottom bunk, even though, like, from the minute we were born, I was always bigger than he was, but like I let him believe that he was the older brother. And we were wrestling in our room like brothers do, and I didn't feel like he was playing by the rules, so I decided that it was time for me to shove his face into the oak bedpost in our room. And I didn't know the impact that was going to have, but it ended up costing him 47 stitches to put his lip back together, which if you've ever had stitches, you know that's a lot of damn stitches to put your lip back together. So that's the kind of kids we were growing up. And we also... we just had like this innate desire to want to like kill everything as kids too, right? So we grew up in a hunting family where our dad, our uncles, everybody hunted, right? And so from a young age, we just wanted to kill things. And again, the story just keeps getting worse, man. This is why I don't tell this story very often. So one of the things we used to like to do is we used to like to trap bees where we grew up in these little airtight containers and just see how long it took for the bees to expire from oxygen deprivation. And it was just like we were, as kids, we wanted to understand this relationship with like death and killing animals. And then, you know, at some point when I think we were like, I think I remember 5 years old when we got our first BB gun, right? That's how most kids, you know, their foray into hunting is through a BB gun. And I wish I could tell you that we wielded the power and responsibility that comes with gun ownership responsibly, but we didn't. We took that gun and we used to kill anything and everything that we could, right? So we went down to the river bottom, we'd kill mostly like lizards and birds. But our favorite thing we used to like to do with that BB gun is my dad had put in the middle of our backyard, very generous of him, to put in a bird feeder. And it was about a 6 foot tall pole. And on top of that pole was a little birdhouse with four dowels coming out each side. It was a honey hole if I've ever had a honey hole. And we used to go out on weekend mornings before my parents would get up. So they'd still be sleeping. My brother and I were getting up before it was even light out. We would go out in the backyard. We would hide behind a bush. And we would just start picking off birds. And it was fun as hell, I got to tell you. But eventually, the songbirds in our neighborhood wised up to what was going on. And we started getting fewer and fewer birds coming to the bird feeder. So we decided that to maintain our catch rate, we had to try our hand at trapping. So we went to my dad's garage and we found some old mouse traps. And we used to set, this sounds so horrible too. We used to set mouse traps and cover them in bird seed. And I know, it just keeps getting worse, man. I like to think that if my mom had ever taken my brother and I to see a psychiatrist or a psychologist, and she would have if she knew, first of all, the things we were doing, she would have explained everything that we did, that person would have told my mom that her dear little boys had behaviors most closely associated with sociopaths and serial killers, just like to watch things die. So we did the mouse trap thing and we did the bird feeder thing, and I'll never forget that it all came crashing down because we got caught the same way most people get caught when they do something bad. It's like trying to get rid of the evidence, right? Where do you hide the bodies? And in our 5 and 6 year old brains, when we were tossing the birds over the fence in the neighbor's yard, they might as well have disappeared from the face of the earth. But it turns out the neighbor's dog had an appetite for songbirds, and it was consuming a lot of birds and then regurgitating a lot of those birds. That's how the neighbor found out about it. And he put two and two together one day when he found a pile of birds in his yard that were right over from our fence. And he came and told my parents, and it all came crashing down. And I'll never forget the day my dad sat me down and was asking me questions about it. And he wanted to know what was going on. And I learned a very important lesson that day. And that lesson is, if you've got a honey hole, don't ever squeal about it. Even to your dad when you're in trouble, okay? Keep those spots to yourself. So I tell you that story because as a kid, I had this insatiable desire to just kill things. And as I got older and I got into, became a legal hunter, finally, for me going hunting, whether we were waterfowl hunting, chucker hunting, deer hunting, it didn't matter. It was simply a transactional thing for me. I thought the whole point of going out was to just kill something or to fill your bag. And the older I got, the more I, like a lot of hunters, you sort of have this evolution, right? You start to understand and appreciate other things about hunting that you didn't appreciate when you were younger. And for me, I'm always someone who's just loved to hunt everything. But there's no doubt at some point along the way, mule deer hunting is something that I just look forward to doing the most. I don't know how that happened or why it happened, but it certainly did happen at some point. I think it's funny too, I was talking with Mark Kenyon last night about whitetail guys versus mule deer guys, and why do people put themselves in these different camps. And I don't necessarily put myself down as a mule deer guy, but I just love hunting mule deer. So I'm going to talk to you today about some of the things that I enjoy about mule deer hunting, some of the lessons that I've learned along the way, and hopefully we'll save a little time at the end to have a conversation. I do want to say up front though that I don't consider myself a mule deer expert in any way, shape, or form. There's a lot of different ways to kill mule deer. These are just some of the things that ways that I hunt mule deer and some of the things that I've learned. So you can decide for yourself whether any of this is useful. Okay? So the first thing I want to talk to you about is I'm going to start out kind of talking a little philosophical, and then I'm going to go a little bit more tactical. Okay? The first thing I want to talk about is one of these things that is really easy to understand, but it takes a lifetime, I feel like, to master. And this is something I struggle with, even though I'm fully aware of what this means. So movement and awareness. In its simplest form, when I talk about movement and awareness, what I'm talking about is the impact you have on your external environment when you're hunting and how you respond to the impact you're having on your external environment and your awareness of your impact on your external environment. I get nods if you understand kind of generally what I'm saying. Okay. I got a lot of blank stares there for a second. So this is, I'm gonna come at this from a few different ways, okay? So, and I think this is applicable to all hunting, but particularly for mule deer hunting, I think this matters because I've said this before and got myself into trouble. I'm gonna say it again because I believe it to be true that if you hunt elk long enough, especially if you hunt during the rut, you're gonna stumble on a big bull. Like anybody can kill a big bull eventually. Like it's just a matter of time and being in the woods. To kill big mule deer is hard. I don't care how long you've done it, it's still going to be hard. And it's a lot harder, I think, than hunting elk. And that's because I think mule deer are just cagier. And unless you're hunting them in the rut, they are hard to find and they're even harder to kill. And you should always be paranoid every time you're going out mule deer hunting. Being paranoid is not a good way to live your life, but it's a good way to hunt mule deer, okay? So let me think about it this way too. Every time you're out in the woods, if you're out hunting, think of it like ripples in a pond, okay? There are impacts that you have when you're out walking. There's like a visual impact, right? So you have a sphere of influence. Like if you're on a ridge, you're visible. Even if you're not on a ridge, you're visible. So maybe the shockwaves you're sending out are smaller. There's an auditory impact, how much noise you're making. And then there's the scent impact, right? Those are all the things you know intuitively. What's hard to know is like what kind of impact are you having on your environment? One of the best presentations I've ever seen about hunting that I learned a lot from, and it really sort of was a big aha moment for me, was not a hunting presentation. It was by this guy, and I cannot remember his name, and he had this whole theory called birdsong. And it was about what you can intuit about what's happening in the woods by the movements and patterns of songbirds primarily, but all birds in the woods. And he used to do this thing where he would take students, and he lived in the Pacific Northwest, and he would take students out on a mountainside, and he would space them out every like 150, 200 yards. And their instructions were very simple. You sit down, and you write everything you observe with a direction, a time, and what you saw. And then he would bring people to get back together after a while to compare their notes. And they would compare their notes chronologically. And one of the things that the students would realize is, let's say one student would observe a deer for a little bit, kind of walking through the woods. Another student would never see that deer. But they might see some songbirds flush. They might see, another bird make a noise over here. And then the next student might see that deer appear through the trees a little bit. And the next student wouldn't see it. And what they would realize is they could map the path of that deer partially based on sight and primarily based just on what else they observed that was happening in the woods. And when I was watching this and listening, I'm like, oh, that's interesting. And I couldn't help but think when I was listening to that we might be able to observe about, the things that are happening in the woods based on what we're seeing. But what about the deer in particular? Like, are they in tune with what's happening with the things the other animals in the woods are doing, and are they paying attention to that? And what are they observing about what's happening in the woods? Okay, so let me explain that in a little bit different way. If you're in your home, and you're attuned to the natural noises in your house, right? So you know the sound your refrigerator compressor makes, you know the sounds your walls make. If you hear a noise that's out of character, you're gonna pay attention right away, right? You're like, never heard that before, what is it? And like your curiosity gets piqued, right? Because that's your home. When you're out hunting mule deer, you're in their home. They live out there all year, right? So when they hear something or see something that they haven't observed the entire summer or the entire fall, like you better damn well believe that their attention gets, their ears go up, or they're on high alert all of a sudden when they weren't before. So this is partly based on observational data. This is not like scientific evidence, but I've observed like mule deer, if you watch them for long enough, you will learn kind of how they pay attention to their surrounding environment, right? Their ears, and they're constantly like looking around their ears, they're bobbing their head all the time, right? So they're in tune with what's going on. So if I'm walking along in the woods and all of a sudden I either set off a squirrel, which, nature's alarm system happens all the time, right? You get a squirrel chattering at you. My first reaction is like, God damn it. My second reaction is like, should I freeze or should I like keep walking? I'll look around to see like what is like my sphere of influence right now. Can I be seen from the far mountainside or not? Or should I just hang tight for another 15 to 20 minutes? So that's kind of what I mean by this, is like, how do you respond when you disrupt the environment that you are in? What do you do about that? When you flush a bird, when you flush some songbirds, are you aware of the impact that you may be having in mule deer country? And you might think that's insignificant, but it's not. Because the reality is, big bucks are, you probably won't even see them most of the time. And if you're lucky enough to see them, it's because you've done something right. But they're very easy to disturb. So that's kind of what I mean by this. Let me talk about it one more way real quick, and I'll move on from this because I feel like I've beaten a dead horse here. But when you're in an observational standpoint, it's really easy to observe what's happening around you and to critique it. When you're actually like moving It's very hard to be aware of your surroundings. A good way to think about this is, have you ever been out hunting and you're like glassing and you see like another hunter or group of hunters and you think to yourself like, what a bunch of idiots. Am I the only one who's thought that before? You see somebody going through an opening where you're like, don't they know there was just something there? Or don't they know yesterday I saw, you know, fill in the blank there. Don't they know that? The reality is probably not. And the reality is that the shoe has probably been on there with the foot at some point when you're out hunting. You just don't know it, right? There's probably somebody watching you. I like to think when guys are watching me, they're like, man, that guy's just got it dialed. He's just like fucking hammering it. Like, look at him. He's just sneaking around. I can barely even tell he's there. That's probably not true, though, right? Like, I'm sure guys have watched me being like, that guy doesn't know anything about hunting. And they're partially right. But when you're in that observational standpoint, it's really easy to observe how somebody else, how they're screwing up. But when you're in the moment, it's really hard to be aware of your what you're doing wrong. I'll give you one example of that real quick. A few years ago, I was hunting mule deer by myself, early season, up high on a ridge. I was glassing two bucks on the far mountainside. They're about 3/4 of a mile away. And I'm watching these two bucks, waiting for them to bed before I put a stock on them. And as I'm sitting there watching them, one of the bucks all of a sudden starts staring daggers straight through me. And I was like, how is that? I'm looking at my spotting scope. I'm like, how the hell does he see me? Like, I'm 3/4 of a mile away. I'm in the shade. I'm in camo. There's no way that deer can see me. But he's just like staring at me and he's not moving. And I'm like, what have I done? Like, I'm looking around. Like, is there something flapping in the wind? Like, nothing. Pretty soon I hear some noise below me. And I see eventually two hunters going below me. These guys were moving very slow. They were like very adept, skilled hunters. They were going through, it's mostly a timbered slope, and they had hit a small opening, right? And they were moving very, very slowly across it. Well, that deer, 3/4 of a mile away, spotted them very, very quickly. Those guys had no idea those two bucks were there. They moved through the opening, went over the ridge, and went out of sight. They never knew I was there. I would not call them unskilled hunters, because I actually met them a few days later. Those dudes knew what they were doing. But a great example of you should be paranoid. There were deer there. They had no idea. They spotted them. You should assume that every time you're in the open, like this is a great example of what not to do, by the way. Every time you're doing this, you're being watched. There is no such thing as like a safe time to go in the opening ever, okay? And I could give you like so many stories of times that I've like tried to like take shortcuts or like, oh, it's only 20 yards. Like I can just... I'll just go 20 yards to the next tree, and then like pretty soon, like I go 10 yards, and then a deer jumps up because I was just being lazy. It happens all the time, and I think it's really, even no matter how much experience you have under your belt, you can always do better. All right, I'll get off this topic real quick. The last thing I want to talk to you about, I almost cut this out of my presentation, but decided to include just a real quick note on it. There's this great Arctic explorer named Stefanson, and this is on the, like the Steve Rinella book list, which is like a great book list if you're ever looking for a reading list. There's a guy named Stefanson who was an Arctic explorer at the turn of the century. He was an ethnographer, and he studied the Eskimo language, and he was like the first white dude to become fluent in Eskimo. And he was like, just a little side note on Stefanson, it's a great book. He was like an original gangster backcountry hunter. This guy lived for like 4 years in the Arctic Circle, off the land completely. He was a classic like early adventurer, and this is obviously before modern gear and equipment. But he has this great quote about adventure. He sort of says this thing tongue in cheek. And his quote is basically that adventure is a sign of incompetence, and adventure really only happens if something has gone wrong, which is sort of funny, you know, given his background. But I think if the only thing I want to say about this is, you know, if I think more guys could do well if they just embraced the value of the adventure part of hunting and just didn't worry as much about the end product, the kill, and just take mule deer hunting as an opportunity to have a fun adventure and just be have that be the thing that you get out of mule deer hunting. And if you kill something, great, but just embrace the adventure part of it. And use it as an opportunity to go check out some new wild country and go check out some place you've never been and push your limits and, you know, scare yourself a little bit, do things that make you a little uncomfortable. All right, I'm going to talk a little bit about, we're going to talk a little bit about gear now. So get away from the philosophical and talk a little gear. I'm just going to put all these on, up here. You can kind of read these while I'm talking. But I feel like backcountry hunting is a very in vogue thing right now. So popular, in fact, I hear there's a group who's named himself after this entire idea. But going light and fast. So to me, the whole point of lightweight hunting, it's strictly about being able to make hunting more enjoyable. That's it, right? It's just about like my motivation, energy, and ability to go to walk further. If I don't have a backpack on, I can walk a long ways. Every ounce and pound that I put on my back, it makes it more difficult. My motivation goes down. I get lazier. That's strictly what it is all about for me, okay? But how do you do it, right? Like, so I always tell people that, like, it's just a matter of money. Like, if you've got a lot of money, like, you can have an incredibly light pack. That's pretty much all you need to do. But there are ways you can, even if you don't want to spend a grip of money, there are a lot of things you can do to lighten up your pack. I thought about skipping this entire segment, just like handing you guys out like a list of like, here's the backpacking list that you can all just take and we can just move on from this topic. There's also a lot of great resources out there. And I feel as a guy who writes a lot about this and who has a website dedicated to like gear and equipment, I feel like there's just so much out there on this that you can go on the internet and find a lot of very, very detailed information on this. So I'm not going to go through like gear list check items, but I will say that if you want to really lighten your pack, there's like the four things you focus on the first when it comes to backpacking. Your four heaviest items in your pack are going to be your backpack, your sleeping pad, your sleeping bag, and your tent. Okay, so focus on those four items first. You're going to have the biggest bang for your buck in terms of space and weight savings by trying to get those like super light. And there's really no reason, to be honest with you, that you have a sleeping bag that weighs more than like a pound and a half in today's day and era, okay? And sleeping pad can be super small and super light, and you can still be super comfortable. There's tons of gear options out there. Think about, like, focus on what you really need, right? So a lot of guys are like, well, I'm going to throw this Leatherman in my backpack because if I need to fix something, I'm going to need a Leatherman to fix that. I have a buddy who does this all the time, and it absolutely drives me nuts. I'm like, what are you going to fix with a Leatherman, man? What are you going to fix? What are you honestly going to fix with a Leatherman? Well, you know, like if I bump my scope and I need to change it, I'm like, you need a Leatherman to like adjust your elevation on your scope? Like, what do you like? Well, you know, if I like my zipper breaks, I'm like, oh, really? That Leatherman's going to come in handy when that zipper breaks? Like, think about it. Tell me like exactly what you need that Leatherman for. And like, you can never answer the question. Well, it's got a screwdriver on it. I'm like, okay. It's got a screwdriver on it. Like, can you use a quarter or a nickel for that? Well, maybe, I might be able to get away with that. It's like, but the thing weighs like a pound and a half, and he always throws it in just in case. It's like his security blanket. And I think we all have those items, right? But you need to be critical, and you need to be brutal about, like, do I really need this thing? Because everything adds up, man. Like, if you're just like, well, shit, I'll just throw that extra bar in there. It's only a couple ounces. It's like, really? Do you need that extra food? Because if it sits in your pack for the whole trip, like, that's wasted space and that's wasted weight. Be brutal about everything in your pack. And if you don't already, you should have a list. Not to be like OCD about it, but you need a list. And you can use that list. My list is like a running gear list. It's always sort of changing a little bit, but the main pieces of it are always the same. So make a list of everything that goes in your pack, down to like the chapstick and toilet paper. Everything goes on that list. And everything is subject to going out or staying on that list. So like every year when I pack, I will lay everything out. And if it's like an early season hunt, I'm going to have a little bit, I'm going to add or take away a few different pieces. But I lay everything out on the ground and I'm like looking at it. And it's like, do I really need that? Like I'm so brutal that to the point where it's like, if say I'm going out archery hunting and you've got a set of Allen wrenches, do you really need an entire Allen wrench set? Or is there like two that you might need on there? And like, what am I really going to fix out in the field versus at my truck? Like, honestly, what am I really going to fix? If my like sight falls off, like, am I really going to like try and get a dial? Maybe I will try and get it dialed in the field, but it's kind of, you know, it could be a little sketchy. So like, just think about everything like that from that lens. And yeah, be honest with yourself about what you're really going to use. And when it comes to clothes, if there is a piece of clothing that sits in your pack, the entire trip and you wear it once, like that's completely an unnecessary piece of clothing. You should have, like, if you pack properly, you will have all your clothes on at the coldest time of your trip, all of them. And you're like, semi-comfortable, you don't have to be totally comfortable, you're semi-comfortable, then you've packed properly. to the point where thinking about like something we always debate is whether or not you need rain gear when you go out hunting. Like I usually take like a light rain jacket, but rain pants, right? Like I rarely take rain pants because, you know, one of the key principles, right, is dual purpose. Can you really just take like a trash bag that you're like got you have in your bag that you might be using to keep some of your stuff dry? And if it's really a downpour, like pull that out, put it over your legs under a tree or something while it's really raining heavily, and then put it back in your bag. So just like thinking about things like that, man. So just being brutal, what do you really need? Don't pack for every possible scenario, pack for the most likely scenario you're gonna encounter when you're out there. I think that's everything. And if you want to talk more about gear specifics, we can talk about that more later. All right, let's talk a little about finding deer. So deer have fairly simple needs, right? Mule deer. They need food, water, and habitat security. That's pretty much it. Water's easy, right? Water's everywhere. Food is also relatively easy, although not all food is created equally. So deer, if you pay attention to what they're eating, if you watch them, they will key in on certain foods at different times of the year, whether that's grasses or shrubs at different periods of the year, and they favor protein-rich food sources, right? So I can remember this one time, this is an elk hunting anecdote, but I'm going to tell it anyway. We were out elk hunting with a buddy. It was early season. There was still a lot of like green vegetation on the ground, and we were in a spot where there were no people. There were lots of elk sign, and we didn't see any elk, and he was just miffed. They're like, why weren't we seeing any elk? Like, there's tons of feed on the ground here. There's water everywhere, and we've got habitat security. And what dawned on me on that trip was that the grass we were seeing, I knew the species of that grass, and I'm like, they don't like this grass. This is not a favorite food source if they have other options. They will much prefer to eat other species of grass. I'm not going to tell you what they prefer because you got to leave something to the imagination here. And it'll vary too by environment too, right? So deer don't always, I like to hunt the mountains because I just like being in the mountains, but there are big deer at pretty much every elevational gradient. So some of the biggest deer that come out of Idaho come out of the low country. Okay. They're coming out of the desert country. They're not coming out of the high country. So if your objective is to kill big deer, take a broad swath approach. Don't necessarily just look at one type of ecosystem and say like, well, everybody likes to hunt in the mountains. That must be where the big deer are. Actually, that's not necessarily the case. So the other thing I'll say about, so that's food, that's water, and then habitat security, which is kind of a little bit harder to find. But habitat security is simply, the way I think about it is just the ability for mule deer to hide. And that can be, you know, far away from a road, or it can actually be relatively close to a road, depending on like traffic. If there's like, you know, a steep slope that's kind of hiding that makes it hard for people to get to the backside of that. Like there's a lot of things that can create habitat security for deer. So it's not necessarily always a really far distance from motorized road or trail, but it can be as well. So this is kind of like a continuation of finding deer, but this is also like a scouting thing. There's a lot of tools out there. For people, when you're looking for a spot to hunt, especially if you're hunting like any of the western states, right? Everyone's using kind of a lot of the same information now. You're looking at like what are, you know, tag draw odds. You're looking at how many, you know, mature bucks are being killed in those units. And you can learn a lot from those services and a lot from the data. But there's a lot of information that'd be gleaned from other sources that most people just aren't paying attention to. And I think it used to be like if you used... I used to crunch all my own data, right? So I have Excel spreadsheets that I would crunch all this information about, and like that would help me figure out what were the like some of the best units to hunt. But now it's like services like GoHunt, like everybody's got that information. It's no longer like an advantage for me to like crunch my own spreadsheets. But there are other ways that you can figure out a lot of information about good places to go hunting. And I'll just share a couple of them with you. I would say there's also a lot of information that's not being told by those spreadsheets. So some of the best units that I hunt in would probably get a very like low score on any of those services. So be careful about what you interpret about a unit based strictly on the data. There could be a unit with low deer densities that has a high percentage of large mature bucks and a hell of a lot fewer hunters that you might want to hunt. And it might be a lot easier to draw too. So actually that should be last. I'm just gonna pull those up here again. You can tell I should have rearranged some of these. So a couple things. So long-term management reports, if you don't do those, this is like something that I feel like everybody should do. So the biologists in every state fishing wildlife management agency are tasked with monitoring the trends of the game populations, right? So they're looking at mortality rates from humans, from predators. They're looking at fawn predation, fawn survival rates. All of that information is compiled by, and that's how they, you know, they use all that information to set seasons. And they're looking at sort of a long-term trend. Well, those reports, a lot of them are publicly available. And if you can find those, you can learn a hell of a lot about what's going on in a particular zone or with a particular herd. And that's really, really valuable information. And oftentimes, I mean, they're very technical reports, but if you can find them, they're worth reading. And if you can track down the biologist who wrote that report, or one of them wrote that report, you might be able to get some information out of them if you know the right questions to ask and you show some curiosity and interest in their work, right? These people put a lot of time and energy and effort into these reports. They are experts. They know a lot. And as long as you don't ask, silly questions like, hey, where are all the big bucks at in this unit? You might be able to get a lot of information from them. Scout Like You Hunt, this is something that I used to pre-marriage and kids, like I used to have a lot of free time to go scout a lot. I don't have that much time anymore. So if I have, I look every year for new places to hunt. So if I get like two new spots to check out every year, I might only have a day for each one of those spots. And so you better believe that one day is going to be spent very efficiently. Let's say it's like end of July. I'm not going to go out and like camp, wake up kind of like slowly, like make some coffee, maybe make a little breakfast, and then like maybe read, and then hit the trailhead, get into where I want to scout at like 11 or noon, glass a little bit, maybe look for some camp spots, and then like wander back to camp and have a few beers and call it a day. Like, that is a very poor use of my time. A better way to do it would be for me to get up like super early, hike in the dark to where I think a place I want to check out, and be there at first light just like I would when it's hunting season. See what I see at first light, bug out of there like mid-morning, like sneak out of there as fast as I can, maybe check out some camp spots and some water on the way out, and spend like half a day scouting. That's a much more efficient way to use my time. And the other reality is, especially when it comes to mule deer, if you're, think back to like the awareness and impact of the awareness and impact you're having on your external environment. If you're like cruising around in the middle of the day, there's a good chance that like you are being seen by something. And if there's a big mule deer buck who's just sitting around watching, like they tend to do the vast majority of daylight hours, there's a good chance you're going to spook whatever is there. So scout like you would hunt and just be more efficient with the way you scout. And then the last thing I would say is like, don't believe anybody. Like, there's this thing that happens, especially in an era of like hunting forums, where like one guy will start a rumor. And then another guy hears that and is like, well, I heard my buddy Ted was telling me that unit's played out. He didn't see anything up in that unit. And like, you shouldn't believe anybody, man. Like, even my own brother, I don't believe when he tells me what he saw. Like, there's a spot we go hunting that, like last year, the spot we've hunted a bunch. And he's like, man, didn't see hardly anything up in there. I think that spot's burned up. I was like, man, forget that. Like, I don't believe you for one second. Like, just because you didn't see anything doesn't mean anything. Like, I'm going to go check it out myself. I'll determine whether or not that spot is burned out or not. So just don't believe anybody. And if you want to get less dudes hunting in your unit, like, start some rumors. That's a good way to get people off your scent. Okay, so now let's, I'm just going to talk real quickly about kind of some different times of the year and some hunting tactics for those times of the year. I'm not going to go super deep on any one of these, but we can talk more about them if you want to. So early season, I kind of described early season as like, this is mostly like archery season, but there are some really good muzzleloader hunts and rifle hunts. So like mid-August through maybe like September 10th, maybe the 15th-ish. This is probably my favorite time of year to be out, just because it can be hot, but it's also, it's kind of like just backpacking, so you don't have to worry about big snow events, although they certainly do happen. You can pack super light. I'm usually just packing a tarp this time of year for a tent. I go super, super basic. You don't have to pack a lot of clothes. It's a very enjoyable time to be out backpacking. And deer, particularly in the mountain ranges, they're on their summer range. They're in their sort of lazy summer habits. where this time of year, all they're doing is like putting on weight, right? So they're eating, they're drinking, and sleeping. That's pretty much it. And like watching out for predators. They're not worried about chasing females. They're not really worried about fighting other dudes. It's all about just putting on weight and just hanging out, right? Just like bros hanging out. And this time of year, they will usually have like an identifiable like home range. And so you have a good chance, if you can find a deer, to see that deer again in that general vicinity. Something I just always warn people about is like, people talk about it, but like patterning bucks. I'm going to pattern this buck. I'm going to figure out like everything he does. And I always tell people, like, be real careful about anthropomorphizing like the behaviors and attitudes of mule deer based on like your human brain. Like, deer are not making logical decisions about where they're going to go lay down. They are creatures of habit. They have instincts, but they do not have the ability to think critically. So if you think, and sometimes they do this based off instinct, but they're not making a decision that like, well, I always go drink water there, so I'm going to go to that water hole, and then I'm going to come back, I'm going to talk with my buddy John over here, and then I'm going to go lay down for a bit. Like, they don't do that. They don't operate that way. They're a wild animal making decisions based off instinct, okay? So just remember that if you're out like trying to pattern a buck. You can. They do have behaviors that can be learned and observed, but just remember they're not making critical decisions. And this time of year, especially in the mountains, like, if you haven't figured it out already, like, I'm fairly paranoid when it comes to mule deer hunting. So if you really want to be paranoid, you can also like backpack in the middle of the night, which I do a fair bit, just to make sure that I'm not disturbing. If I'm going into open country, or early, get up super early and backpack into where you want to go in the dark, if there's any chance you might be disturbing anything on the way in. Because as a rule, remember, you should always be concerned about your impact on the external environment. But hanging out up high, one of the things I also really like to do during the early season is glassing bedded bucks. It's incredibly boring and incredibly painstaking, but if you commit to it, and you know, I will like, so after the morning, if I don't see anything moving around that I want to go after, I will, you know, from the hours of about like 11 to 2, I'm not one of those guys that sleeps in the woods during the middle of the day. I don't know how people do that, actually, to be honest with you, when you're out hunting. And it might just be a product of the fact that now that I have kids, like, I feel like I got to make, you know, the most of my time out in the woods. But during those hours, if you're up high, like glassing down, you know, you can just like move, like I will move like literally like 10 yards and just like glass the same exact spots. If it's in an area where I think there might be deer, I will like glass, 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 sneak, 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 glass, 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 glass. And I'll do that and I'll just cover a very short distance. But oftentimes, you will be able to find like a piece of an antler or something from a deer bedded down if you know they're in that general zone. Mid-season hunting tactics. I think this is like the worst time to go hunting, to be honest with you. And this is the time that also coincides with most of the general hunting season tags that are available. So this could be like late September through, I'll say like end of October. The reason I think this is the hardest, it's the worst time just because there's the majority of people is when they're out in the woods, which makes it really hard to find nice mule deer. Not to say you can't, not to say you won't, but it also makes it the hardest. If you are going to go hunting this time of year, I think your best bet is to go like the first few days of the season and call it quits until the very end of the season. Unless you have some sort of big like a snow event or some sort of big weather event that might get deer moving around again. I can remember talking to one biologist one time about the migratory patterns of this particular place, and talking about, you know, when did the deer migrate? What causes the migration? And for the most part, as best we can tell, according to the biologists, you know, the migration of deer is mostly closely triggered by like sight patterns, sight pictures. So like length of day, maybe even sight picture of the vegetation, right? That's what triggers migration. Most people like erroneously believe that like a big snow event will get mule deer to migrate if it happens early. That's actually, for the most part, not actually that accurate. Most mule deer, they will push down, but they're not necessarily going to start their migration if you get like a big snow event. In most places, okay? But in the mid-season, like, I will still hunt mule deer up high if I'm in the same places I actually hunt in like August during the mid-season, depending on where I'm hunting. Usually I'm not hunting the same deer that I would be hunting in early, late August, early September. I'm hunting deer that might be starting to migrate through, that country, but you could still find them up high. This time of year, you know, again, like deer might be, actually, I forgot to finish my train of thought on the migration. So the other thing about migration that this particular biologist reminded me of is like the deer migration in some places is very closely associated with the opening of rifle season. So there is something about a bunch of dudes being in the woods shooting guns and pushing deer around that causes deer to like be like, holy shit, maybe it's time we get out of here. And so they might move down, and then they might just start walking towards their winter grounds, however far that is away. And especially if you're hunting a spot, like it's important to also, you know, do a little homework and figure out where are those deer wintering. Because if their winter ground isn't that far away, they will stay up high until they absolutely have to move down, especially big bucks. They, you know, a foot of snow is not going to scare a big buck away. They are not worried about a foot of snow as long as they have some browse habitat. And they are not going to come down. So don't be afraid to hunt high. The last season, this is a really fun time. This is mostly what I would call, like, for mule deer, is mostly the rut. So think of November. This time of year, you can hunt high or low. This can depend on a lot of different factors. I prefer to actually still hunt relatively high. If there's a lot of snow on the ground, I'll be up hunting in up to a foot of snow, because I know that the big mule deer, as long as they have some of their basic needs being met, they can still be up there, and they don't like to come down. But this time of year, they're only thinking about females. So I'm not primarily looking for bucks at this point in the time of year. I'm looking for drainages with a lot of does. And if I find a good spot with a lot of does where does are mingling about or hanging out, I will come back to that same exact spot day after day after day after day. Because bucks at that time of year, they're coming, they're finding does, they're checking them, and they're moving on. Or they're breeding them, and then they're moving on, right? They might hang out with a hot, if you got a hot doe, they're going to hang around. But for the, they'll be moving around and covering ground. And if you see one day, it's a good chance you're never going to see that buck again. So if you just hang around does long enough, like, you will see a lot of deer like wander around. And it could be all day long, too. So incredibly fun time of year. One other strategy, too, is if you can figure out sort of the migratory patterns. I've also hunted mule deer late season with a bow, sort of like you're like, tree stand hunting for whitetails. If you can like observe those patterns, and you can actually find some of the places, the migratory routes they use, and that can be a lot of fun too. All right, that's it on mule deer strategy. A couple takeaways that if you take nothing away from this, I would say this is like one of the more important things. For me, you know, mule deer hunting is all about being a student and learning that you're just recognizing that you never know everything. You always have something to learn. So when you're out in the woods, look at every opportunity as an opportunity to learn something. You never will, you know, fully have it dialed. I don't care how many big bucks you've killed. Like, you always have something to learn. Take a notebook. Pay attention to what with you. Pay attention to what they're eating. Pay attention to, like, any behaviors you might observe. And just, like, be open to learning something new every time you go out. Some random parting thoughts. This is me trying to be... To understand the elk, you have to be the elk sometimes. These are like parting thoughts, and we can kind of have this in a little conversation with the group. But just some like things I didn't know where to put. Hunting solo or taking chances. I have some friends who are so like paralyzed about failure that they just like, oh, I don't know if I can make that stock, man. I think I'm just going to hold back and wait for a better opportunity. And where I'm like, dude, take that stock, like, right now. Like, it's right there. Like, I think you can do it. Like, just go for it. See what happens. Like, don't be afraid to take chances. Like, don't make dumb choices. But make smart choices. But don't be afraid to take some chances. Hunting solo versus hunting with friends. I feel like everybody should hunt solo more often than they do. If for no other reason than allows you to, like, politely be more selfish. Like, if I'm hunting with my buddies and we both see a, you know, a nice deer, I'm gonna be like, oh no, man, it's all yours. Like, you should shoot it. Like, absolutely. And it might be like the Catholic guilt that I grew up with from my mom, like always telling me to like be polite to people. But I think you also hunt different when you hunt by yourself. There's a very different, like, I don't know, you're not like bouncing ideas like, hey, you think we should go over there? Or, you know, what should we think we should do? It's just you making decisions and following your instincts. And I like hunting with people too, but I find that I hunt alone a lot. Other thing too is like, I hear a lot, like, people just complain like, man, just don't have time for it this year. You know, I really want to do it, but it's got a lot of irons in the fire. Just can't go out hunting as much as I want to. And I'm always like, really? You just went to like Hawaii for 2 weeks. You went to like, you know, you went down to like Southern California for a beach vacation. I'm like, I'm thinking about all the things I know about that person. I'm like, it's not that you don't have time. It's just not a priority in your life, right? So like, make it a priority. Like, if you want to go out, if you live out in the Midwest and you want to come out mule deer hunting, like, it's totally feasible, right? It's not that complicated. Just make it a priority. And if you live out west and you're not hunting mule deer as much as you want, like, you got no excuses, man. Come talk to me later and we can talk about prioritizing your life a little bit better. I got a buddy, I got a buddy who, he's a single dude and he has turned away, a lot of very like quality, relationships for the desire to prioritize hunting. I don't recommend that. Like, I think everybody should be in a relationship of some type. And then visualize success. Like, I grew up playing college soccer, and one of the things we had this sports psychologist, and he used to go through this whole thing about visualizing success, like visualizing yourself doing the thing that you want to do. And it sounded really hokey to me at the time, but it's like one of the most valuable things I learned, and I do that all the time. Like, visualizing myself like taking the shot I want to take without like, you know, let, you know, completely like separating yourself, like you're watching yourself doing it, like closing your eyes, watching yourself take the shot, or watching, you know, visualizing yourself drawing your bow back, you know, settling your pin, and like, you know, casually, you know, letting your bow surprise you and all that. Like, doing that, even when I'm like mid stock or like waiting for a buck to get up, like I put the stock in and I'm like just waiting for the buck to stand up, like I will visualize myself doing the thing that I want to do. And you would be amazed, if you don't already do this, like how much success that can bring to your execution. And then just generally hunt as often as you can. I think that's all I got, guys. Oh, wait. Oh, yeah. Learn to hunt with every weapon. That's something that, like, you definitely, like, become proficient with every weapon if you want to, like, increase your opportunities for hunting across the West. So learn how to do everything. With that, I appreciate you guys coming. Anybody have any questions or anything you want to talk about? Oh, you go first right there, and then you go second. Good question. Did you see that beginning slide? Let me show you this again. I gotta go way back. So I am fairly anal about where I camp. In this particular camp, I started hiking at 11 at night and got in at 3 in the morning. And I pitched a tent underneath a tree, and you can't really tell here, but that's a deer bed up against a log where nothing could see me and the wind was going. I like to camp relatively close to where I'm going to be hunting that day if I can. The downside is obviously getting water. But I try and just pick a spot that's not exposed. It's not in a place where I think deer are going to be like moving around in, so I'm not going to get like caught. But it's always a challenge. If I can camp like a little lower next to a water source, like, and then like, you know, do day hunts from there, I'll do that. But oftentimes I find that when I'm planning out a hunt, like I'll pick like a big circle I'm going to do. And so I will just like, I'll have everything with me. So I'll camp one night, okay, like this. And then I packed up at first, like I have everything in my backpack, and then I'm just hunting. And then that night, the next night actually after I made this camp, as an example, like I just picked a spot that was in some trees. It was secluded, so nothing could see me. And I was just sleeping in a deer bed. It wasn't that comfortable, but I just try and stay as like incognito as possible.
Do you consider, I hear a lot about escape routes, especially in the early season and up high? I mean, do you consider those or what?
For deer that have escape routes?
Yeah.
I don't think, you know, a big buck or mature bucks, they like to have like multiple options for moving around. So if there's like, so like example in the background there, you can see that huge steep cliff face. Like there's a huge cliff basin right there. I wouldn't expect that there would be a deer, like they could be like right below that cliff face, but you know, just based on my experience, like they're going to want to have a few options to like escape. So they might have a hidey hole and a way to get out of there. So I do think about that, but I don't know if I'm answering your question or not. But so yes.
I've just heard people say, you know, considering other state routes too, trying to be in those as well.
Yeah, unless you're trying to ambush them.
Yeah.
Yeah. What you got?
Back from light. So if you're going to go in, you know, fairly steep and remote, early season, are you taking binoculars, spotting scope, and your tripod?
Yes. Okay. All of it. I glass off my tripod 80% of the time now, especially for mule deer. Elk are easy to spot, right? Like, it's not, you don't need a magnifying glass to see elk. But mule deer can be really hard to spot, especially after they start turning gray, right? So late summer, they're still, like, you'll find some in their red coats, and they stand out really well. That's another reason that I like hunting them early. But right about, you know, first part of September, in the Intermountain West, they start turning gray, and they start getting a lot harder to see. I don't pack a huge spotting scope because I don't really care about counting, like, the inches on a deer. I have buddies who always pack an 85 mil spotter. I don't pack one that big because I can usually get a sense of how big a deer is just off a, you know, smaller spotting scope. But, yeah, it's a lot of weight.
What's your pack weigh, like, on a 5-day trip?
Let's see. With water, probably about, like, 32 pounds for an early season trip. Like, later in the year, though, as I add more clothes. And it depends on the number of days, too. So, like, 5 days. Actually, probably, like, 35 pounds. Yep. You were first.
Down or synthetic bag?
Down. Synthetic, man, I just feel like those things, like, they don't pack down as small. I've never had as good luck with synthetic material. People worry about, like, rain, getting your sleeping bag wet. I've never really had that be an issue. Even the biggest problem you have is if you're using a single wall tent late season, you get condensation in the middle on your tent, and that will drip down your bag, and that will get it wet. But you should be more worried about that than you are about rain getting on your tent. But some down is just so much more compact, and you get a lot more bang for your buck in terms of warmth to weight ratio. Somebody else? Yep. Just like, you know, find your religion and hope for the best. That's the best thing I got to say for you, man. That, dude, I had a video of, the next camp I built on this trip, we had a big old thunder boomer rolling in, and it was just pounding me. And lightning was striking all the ridges around me, and I was just like, man, what are you doing up here? I don't know. Like, I notice I don't think I have a lot of metal objects in there. I do kind of take stock of what's around me to see if, like, you can see any lightning struck trees around there. And I don't know. I think your chance of getting struck by lightning are so low. I mean, if it's really, really bad, I might duck down, but... Man, I don't know. I just don't worry about it.
It's worse than, like, the Southern Rockies where you have the monsoons and the buildup a lot more than other places.
Yeah, like Northern Rockies, isn't it? I don't know. I worry about it more when I'm out, like, rock climbing on a tall rock face by myself and I've got a bunch of metal on my body than I do when I'm out hunting, I guess. But I don't know. Some guys worry about it. I don't know. It's just never been something I really pay a whole lot of attention to. I worry more about, like, snakes than I do about lightning early season. So, yep.
How many calories per day do you pack?
I eat a lot. So I probably, let's see, how many calories do I pack a day? Probably about, like, I'll do like 4,000 calories a day. And I just snack throughout the day. So I have all my, this is the other thing I didn't talk about, is like, you should have all your meals. Like, it helps to plan all your meals. Like, have like a lunch, pack like 5 lunches in a quart Ziploc bag. So whatever you're going to eat for that day, have it all in a bag. So it's like I'm going on 3 days. I just like pack 3 of those things, right? And I have my breakfast and my dinners all like lined out and they're already planned. So when I'm packing food, I'm not like, I'll just throw in this like Trader Joe's like mixed nut bag and I'll probably just munch on that for a while. It's like, I can never do that, man. I have it all like dialed. Like, this is exactly, I know how much I'm going to eat and how much it's going to take to keep me going. So it's all planned out. Yep. Like I usually will have about like 2 liters on me, and I don't know, there's usually in most places, like I know I can get away without carrying more than like 3 total for like, I don't know, day and a half or so. So like if I'm getting water every other day and I have to drop down, like if I have to drop down no more than like 1500 feet to get water, I'm okay with that. And if it's within like, you know, a mile or two, then I'm okay with that. So a lot of what I do when I'm scouting too is I'm looking for water sources, looking for places where I know that I can kind of, if you know, sometimes those are lakes. Sometimes I don't know where I'm going to get water and I'm just kind of winging it. But I don't know, it's kind of a sacrifice I'm willing to make, is just not knowing where my next water is going to come from. But I know it's around, so I'm not like stressing it. And if things really got bad, I could walk the extra like 3 miles back to where I got my last water, 4 miles, whatever it is. So, yep.
How do you feel about frame backpacks?
External frame?
Yeah. Like the metal frame, like the ones that
come on the back. So without getting too like brand specific, there's a lot of really good backpacks out there. I don't necessarily, like I have a couple different brands that I use. I think it comes down to more like, what do you got there, 5 minutes? Thanks, buddy. So I don't know, man. It depends on what works for you. So you can use anything, and you can hunt in blue jeans and a flannel shirt if you want to, right? Like you don't have to have anything necessarily. So if you have an external frame backpack that you like and works really well for you, use it. It just comes down to like, it's just money, right? So if you want to like spend a lot of money on a fancy backpack, you can, but you don't need to. It's not going to make a bit of difference on how you hunt. It'll make your like camping life a little bit more comfortable if you have like a nice backpack, but I wouldn't stress about it. There are. You can come talk to me later. Come find me in my booth and we can talk about the pros and cons. But I would say it's just about comfort and your ability to, you know, your desire to want to be comfortable while you're out hiking and backpacking. Yep.
The last comment you made about hunting in jeans. What's your perspective on camouflage and how important it is?
Oh man. We could have a whole nother talk on that. I think camo, it can be important. I think people spend more time thinking about their camo than they do about learning how to hunt. That's my comment on camo. Yep.
So you said the big four are where you want to lose weight?
Yep, through backpacking kit, yeah.
In your history of backpacking, what's the one biggest thing you did, either in those big four or outside those big four, that changed the game?
For just my weight?
Yeah. Or your overall comfort in your experience?
I think it's kind of all of them, man. I don't think there's one in particular. Like sleeping, your tent in particular, like a lot of dudes will like carry, like, I mean, I used to do this too. My first backpacking tent weighed 7.5 pounds, and I thought that was like a normal backpacking tent. I'm like, well, I guess this is what I'm carrying. And it was huge. I still remember I was like 15 and I bought it at REI. I still have that tent. But when it sort of opened my eyes when I realized I could just carry that like 15-ounce tarp early season and be just fine. So that was a huge weight savings, obviously. But then I would say like the whole quilt thing, I really just got into taking a quilt, and quilts are great for early season. I froze my butt off in November last year using one in some pretty frigid temperatures. But to go from a sleeping bag that weighed even a couple pounds to like 3/4 of a pound was a big weight savings. And they packed down, you know, a quilt is like, yeah. Yeah. And if you want a full, there's some like Western Mountaineering makes a great small sleeping bag. There's a lot of good options out there. Yep. Yep. Yeah, that's a good point. Thanks, Katie. Yeah.
Day after draw is a bad time.
Yep. Yep. Let's do the last question, then we'll.
If you hike at night for light sources or colors of light, is there any preference that you found that works better?
I just use infrared light. Yep. Yeah, on my headlamp. All right. Thanks, guys, for coming. Appreciate it.
All right, thanks for listening, and as always, check us out at AveryAdventures.com and on YouTube at Avery Adventures. Thanks.